Side 7, Imperial Earth, beginning on page 293. Yet it was hard to realize that even if Argus was built, no human eye could ever see it in its entirety. The structure would be so huge that its slender rods and wires would be totally invisible from any distance. Perhaps, as Carl had suggested in his notes, there would be warning lights dotted all over the millions of square kilometers of the spherical surface and strung along the six principal axes. To an approaching spaceship, it would look like some glittering Star Day ornament. Or, and this was more appropriate, a discarded toy from the nursery of the gods. Toward evening, while he was waiting for the shuttle back to the mainland, Duncan found a secluded corner of the coffee shop Kumbar, which overlooked the lagoon. He sat there thoughtfully, sipping from time to time at a Terran drink he had discovered, something called a Tom Collins. It was a bad idea, acquiring vices which could not be exported to Titan. On the other hand, it could equally well be argued that it was foolish not to enjoy the unique pleasures of Earth, even if one had to relinquish them all too soon. There was also endless enjoyment in watching the play of wind over the water, protected by the barrier of the inner reef. Some stretches were absolutely flat, reflecting the blue of the unclouded sky as if in a flawless mirror. Yet other areas, apparently no different, were continually quivering so that not for a moment was the surface still. It was crossed and crisscrossed by innumerable tiny wavelets, no more than a centimeter in height. Presumably, some relationship between the varying depth of the lagoon and the velocity of the wind was responsible for the phenomenon, quite unlike anything that Duncan had ever before seen. No matter what the explanation, it was enchantingly beautiful, for the countless reflections of the sun in the dancing water created sparkling patterns that seemed to move forever down the wind, yet remained always in the same spot. Duncan had never been hypnotized, nor had he experienced more than a few of the nine states of consciousness between full awareness and profound sleep. The alcohol might have helped, but the scintillating sea was undoubtedly the main factor in producing his present mood. He was completely alert. Indeed, his mind seemed to be working with unusual clarity. But he no longer felt bound by the laws of logic that had controlled all his life. It was almost as if he was in one of those dreams where the most fantastic things can happen and are accepted, as matter-of-fact, everyday occurrences. He knew that he was facing a mystery of the sort that was anathema to the reputedly hard-headed Mackenzies. Here was something that he could never explain to Malcolm and Cullen. They would not laugh at him, or so he hoped, but they would never take him seriously. Besides, it was so utterly trivial. He had not been vouchsafed some blinding revelation like an ancient prophet receiving the word of God. All that had happened was that he had come across the same very unusual shape in two quite independent contexts. It might have been a mere coincidence, and the sense of déjà vu pure self-delusion. That was the simple, logical answer, which would certainly satisfy everyone else. It would never satisfy Duncan. He had experienced that indescribable shock a man may know only once in a lifetime, when he is in the presence of the transcendental and feels the sure foundations of his world and his philosophy trembling beneath his feet. When he saw that careful drawing in Carl's sketchbook, Duncan had recognized it at once. But now it seemed to him that the recognition came not only from the past, but also from the future. It was as if he had caught a momentary glimpse in the mirror of time, reflecting something that had not yet occurred, and something that must be awesomely important for it to have succeeded in reversing the flow of causality. Project Argus was part of the destiny of mankind. Of this Duncan was now sure beyond any need for rational proof. But whether it would be beneficent was another question. All knowledge was a two-edged sword, and it might well be that any messages from the stars would not be to the liking of the human race. Duncan remembered the dying cries of the sea urchin he had killed out there on the Golden Reef. Were those faint but sinister crepitations wholly meaningless? An accidental byproduct? Or did they have some more profound significance? His instincts gave him not the slightest clue, one way or the other. But it was an act of faith to Duncan, and to those he had worked with all his life, that it was cowardice not to face the truth, whatever it might be, and wherever it might lead. If the time was coming for mankind to face the powers behind the stars, so be it. He had no doubts. All he felt now was a calm contentment, even if it was the calm at the center of the cyclone. Duncan watched the light trembling and dancing on the lagoon as the sun sank lower and lower toward the horizon and the hidden coast of Africa. Sometimes he thought he could see, in those flaring, coruscating patterns, the warning beacons of Argus, staking a claim to the billions of cubic kilometers of space they enclosed 50 or 100 years from now. Changing shape even as Duncan watched, the sun kissed the horizon and spread out, a crimson, bell-shaped skirt across the sea. Now it looked like the film of an atomic blast, but run backwards so that the fires of hell sank harmlessly into the ocean. The last golden arc of the departing disk lingered on the edge of the world for an instant, and at the very second it disappeared, there was a momentary flash of green. As long as Duncan lived, he might never see such heartbreaking beauty again. It was a memory to take back to Titan, from the island on which he had made the great decision of his life, and opened the next chapter in the story of the Outer Worlds. Part 4. Titan. Chapter 43. Homecoming. It was over. All the goodbyes had been said to crew and passengers, all the formalities had been completed, everything he had brought from Earth was already moving along the conveyor belt. Everything, that is, except for the most important gift of all. He could walk through that door marked Titan Citizens, and he would be home. Already he had forgotten the crippling gravity of Earth. That, and so much else, was fading into the past like a dissolving dream. This was where he belonged, and where his life's work would be done. He would never again go sunward, though he knew there would be times when some remembered beauty of the Mother World would drive a dagger into his heart. The family must be waiting, there in the reception lounge. And now, with only seconds before the moment of reunion, Duncan felt a reluctance to face the whole Mackenzie clan. He let the other travelers go hurrying past him, while he stood irresolutely, trying to pluck up his courage and clutching his precious bundle awkwardly to his chest. Then he moved forward, under the archway and out onto the ramp. There were so many of them. Malcolm and Colin, of course. Marissa, more beautiful and desirable than even in his most restless dreams, now free of Kalindi forever. Clyde and Carlene. Could she really have grown so much in so short a time? And at least 20 nephews and nieces whose names he knew as well as his own, but just couldn't recall at the moment. No, it was impossible. But there she was, standing a little apart from the others, leaning heavily on her cane, yet otherwise completely unaltered since he had last seen her on the cliffs of Loch Helbrew. Much else had changed, indeed, if Grandma Ellen had returned to Oasis for the first time in 50 years. As she saw Duncan's astonished gaze, she gave a barely perceptible smile. It was more than a greeting. It was a signal of reassurance. She already knows, thought Duncan. She knows and approves. When the full fury of the Mackenzies breaks upon my head, I can rely on her. There flashed into his mind an old Terran phrase whose origin he had long ago forgotten, the moment of truth. Well, here it was. They all crowded eagerly around him as he drew back the shawl. For an instant only, he felt regret. Perhaps he should have given some warning. No, it was better this way. Now they would learn that he was his own man at last, no longer a pawn of others, however much he might owe to them, however much he might be part of them. The child was still sleeping, but normally now, not in the electronic trance that had protected it on the long voyage from Earth. Suddenly it threw out a chubby arm and tiny fingers gripped Duncan's hand with surprising strength. They looked like the pale white tentacles of a sea anemone against the dark brown of Duncan's skin. The little head was still empty, even of dreams, and the face was as void and formless as that of any month-old baby. But already the smooth pink scalp bore an unmistakable trace of hair, the golden hair, that would soon bring back to Titan the lost glories of the distant sun. Acknowledgements and notes. My first thanks should go to Truman Talley, who in the early 50s made what was then, and for that matter still is, a most generous offer for this book on the strength of the title and one conversation. I have often wished that I could remember what I said then. It might have saved me much trouble 20 years later. I now have no idea if this book bears the slightest resemblance to that early concept, but Mac's initial encouragement kept me from abandoning it. Like many other addicts, I was introduced to polyominoes by Martin Gardner's Scientific American Book of Mathematical Puzzles and Diversions, which, however, fiendishly refrains from giving the solution to the 20x3 rectangle. In his definitive book, Polyominoes, Solomon W. Golome takes mercy on his readers. In the hope of preventing a few nervous breakdowns, I reproduce his answer herewith. UXPILNFTWYZV. Anyone who wishes to construct this rectangle from the 12 pentominoes should have no difficulty in matching them with the letters they sometimes approximately resemble. it is easy to see that the second of the only two solutions is obtained by rotating a seven-element central portion. Dr. Golom, who is now a professor of electrical engineering and mathematics at the University of Southern California, has also invented an ingenious game called Pentominoes, distributed in North America by Hallmark Cards and in Europe by Zimpfer Puzzles. It has more openings than chess. In an earlier version of 2001, A Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick shot Hal playing this game against the astronauts. I am indebted to Dr. Robert Forward of the Hughes Research Laboratory, Malibu, for introducing me to the fascinating concept of mini black holes, and for making such encouraging noises about the somewhat outrageous propulsion system of SS Sirius that I am almost inclined to patent it. Dr. Grote Reber, the father of radio astronomy and builder of the world's first radio telescope, started me thinking about the extent of the heliosphere and its possible consequences. I am grateful for his comments on cutoff frequencies, but he is in no way responsible for my wilder extrapolations of his ideas. Dr. Adrian Webster, of Cavendish Laboratory's Mullard Radio Astronomy Observatory, also gave much vital information, and he too is not to be blamed for my use of it. I am especially indebted to Dr. Bernard Oliver, Vice President and Director of Research of Hewlett-Packard, not only for hospitality at Palo Alto, but also for an advance copy of the Project Cyclops Design Study, NASA Ames CR114445, which he directed. And I hope Barney will forgive me for the assumption, which in fact I regard as highly improbable, that Cyclops would not have detected intelligence signals even after 200 years of operation. Indignant antenna designers who feel that Argus would not work as specified are invited to contemplate ABM search radars and to think big. All I will say in self-defense is that the Argus elements would be superconducting, active, and divided into many switchable subsections, perhaps with cross-connections between the spines. I leave minor practical details, as in the case of the asymptotic drive, as an exercise for the student. The exasperated remark in Chapter 21 was made to me at a NASA conference by Professor Neil Armstrong in July 1970. I hope it is the last word on some famous first words. I am deeply grateful to my old friend, William McQuitty, producer of A Night to Remember, for much material concerning the Titanic, including the menu in Chapter 27. Collectors of unlikely coincidences may be interested to know that just 3 hours after I had decided to incorporate it in the text, I read in the May 1974 Skindiver that the Titanic enthusiasts of America had served this menu at their annual dinner. Some readers may feel that the coincidences or correspondences that play a key part in this story are too unlikely to be plausible. But they were, in fact, suggested by far more preposterous events in my own life. And anyone who doubts that this sort of thing can happen is referred to Arthur Koestler's The Roots of Coincidence. I read this fascinating book only after completing Imperial Earth, though that fact itself now seems somewhat improbable to me. Even more improbable is the fact that when on July 24, 1975, I appeared as a witness before the House of Representatives Subcommittee on Space Science, in the very building libeled and demolished in Chapter 33, I was able to quote extensively from Duncan's address to Congress in Chapter 41. Thus, the House of Representatives hearings now contain extracts from the Congressional Record for July 4th, 2276, which should cause confusion among future historians. The curious acoustic behavior of the spiny sea urchin, Diadema setosum, was observed by me on Unawatuna Reef off the south coast of Sri Lanka. I have never seen this recorded elsewhere, so it may be my one original contribution to marine biology. Finally, my speculations about conditions on Titan were triggered by a series of papers that Dr. Carl Sagan was good enough to send me. Needless to say, I am also indebted to Carl for many other stimulating ideas, which any properly designed universe would be very foolish to ignore. For if not true, they are well imagined. Arthur C. Clarke, Cinnamon Gardens, Colombo, January 1974 through January 1975. End of Imperial Earth by Arthur C. Clarke. Copyright 1976.